What you can do as a stoic is just do the best you possibly can. You can't control people's reaction to your work. I think it was Epictetus talked about the lute player or the, some sort of ancient instrument, and you can practice all you like and you get on stage and, you could be out in an amphitheater and it's windy and you're playing really well, but the sound doesn't travel to the audience and you get booed and, that is out of your control, that weather. But your practice, your passion, turning up on time, that's all within your control.
Journalist and author Bridget Delaney reckons we could learn a lot about how to live well now from ancient Stoic philosophers. This is the Liz Earle Wellbeing Show, the podcast helping us all have a better second half. I'm Liz Earle, and I'm on quite a mission to find ways for all of us to thrive in later life by investing in our health and our well-being today. Now, I wonder if you feel you live by a certain philosophy. Do you have principles or values that you call on in particular trying or chaotic or unpredictable moments? I have learnt that there's no point in trying to be a perfectionist. That's my kind of default. And I've learnt that if it's mostly good most of the time, then that's enough, frankly. Also, I have learnt to try and worry less about the things I have absolutely no control over. And I guess these could be considered my own personal philosophies. Well, Bridget Delaney is a journalist for The Guardian in Australia. She is the author of great books, including This Restless Life and Wellmania. And for the past few years, she's been living life like the ancient Stoic philosophers. In researching for her book, Reasons Not to Worry, How to Be a Stoic in Chaotic Times, Bridget found a time not completely unlike our own. There was war, plague, corruption, anxiety, and overindulgence. So despite a 2,000-year gap, what did the Stoics know about tranquility and a sense of agency that we could take heed of today?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Well, welcome, Bridget. And can we start actually with the question, what is Stoicism? I mean, I think probably we use it nowadays to describe people who are quite stiff upper lip, as we say here in the UK. You know, they don't display too much emotion. They're maybe quite calm and rational. But are we talking about something a bit different here?
Well, yes, the British really own that second definition of Stoicism, particularly, you know, after the Blitz and keep calm and carry on. But it has a completely different meaning. It comes from the Greek word stoa, which is the painted porch in Athens, where philosophers and the public used to gather and debate ideas.
Really?
A very long time ago, 350, 300 BC. So Stoicism, the school of philosophy, got its name from the Stoa. And over time, like, language does change. So, you know, it has kind of, its meaning has become a bit perverted. But Stoicism, you know, proper noun, is certainly not a stiff upper lip philosophy.
That's so interesting to hear about the history of it. And when did you personally become so interested in Stoicism? What was your journey?
Well, my journey, like a lot of journalists who are struggling for ideas, you know, we get press releases and we get all sorts of tips on stories to write. And I was working for The Guardian in Australia and doing a weekly column called Bridget Delaney's Diary. And each week I'd write about something that was happening in my life. And a friend on the foreign desk sent me a press release from, I think it was Exeter University, which was Live Like a Stoic for a Week. So the invitation was to join an online group of people from all over the world who were learning about Stoicism and trying to practice it. Mm. And so I joined this group. I did the work, but I found it a little bit dense and I didn't have much of a background at all in the ideas. So I wrote kind of a bit of a joke column that didn't take it very seriously. And then, you know, I got emails, as I do with a lot of columns, pointing out that had I approached it with more seriousness, I could have learnt something from it. So I took that feedback on, and the following year I went back and did the course kind of just as a private individual, not to write about. Mm-hmm. Did it with some friends, and we had a WhatsApp group. And I found the second time around it was fantastic. And, you know, this was prior to the pandemic, so I was learning about it just before the pandemic hit. And when the pandemic hit, it really was very useful.
How interesting. So what did the course involve, and how did it change that week when you were doing it?
So it involved lessons or readings each day and discussion, and you'd do the reading. You might put in the forum what you think of it, how it relates to your life. You know, there'll be an expert who'll also be kind of coming into the forums and talking a bit about Stoicism. So in my group, my second time around, my WhatsApp group, we did the readings together, and then we talked about what was going on in our lives at the time. So someone had a new baby, someone was struggling with mental health issues, there was another person, you know, saving to buy an apartment. And so we, as a group, we workshopped our problems with this Stoicism that we were learning.
As a Stoic.
Yeah, and it was good on a number of levels. The first one was to engage with your friends at a deeper level. You know, what are they going through? You know, they don't have to go through it alone. But then being able to apply a philosophy and support your friends using that philosophy to overcome adversity, I think is a really great model.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because I think we live in a time now when feelings and emotions are really validated. And in order to be conscious of people's mental health, the advice is to acknowledge all extremes of emotion. What does Stoicism say about that? Do the Stoics have a different way, perhaps, of finding calm?
Yeah, I think the extremes of emotion are not something to be welcomed.
Right.
So it's very different from nowadays, which is it's okay to feel what you feel, and that's all great. The Stoics would say what you should try and achieve is this tranquility, or they call it ataraxia, which is a very relaxed, chilled, not perturbed frame of mind.
Right.
And when you achieve that, and you achieve it over the day, over the night, it's not just for a minute, you have to be relaxed fairly constantly, you're less likely to be upset and then suffer when adversity happens to you. So if you've got a heightened state of emotion, think about like when you've just had a fight with someone, a fight with your partner or a fight with your kid, or your boss, and then you're furious, and then you get behind the wheel of your car, and then someone cuts you off, you're not going to respond very well in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you're already heightened.
Mm-hmm.
So the Stoics kind of talk about these circles of relationships. It's not just a Stoic idea, it's also a Buddhist one. But it's, you know, you have an emotion that may feel specific to you. But if you don't deal with it, it then does spill out to strangers and to, you know, people around you, your colleagues. And so you can create either peace or disturbance within how you act in your own life.
I think that whole notion of ataraxia is really interesting. You know, it's a word that I've never heard before. Is that kind of unique to Stoicism? Because there's a lot of talk, isn't there, at the moment about finding happiness. People talk about the need to be happy and how we can stay happy. But is that too dependent perhaps on external factors? Because you say in the book that Stoics tend not to do those high highs. Is that actually what ataraxia is about instead, finding that kind of level calm?
Absolutely. And it's a calm that's not dependent on externals. So
right.
The Stoics have this thing called preferred indifference, which is
I love that.
You prefer something. So I would prefer. Uh-huh. So Taylor Swift is on tonight in Sydney, where I'm taking this call. Mm-hmm. And I would have preferred to get tickets, but right. I didn't. I was okay. online trying. But I'm not upset about it because even though it was a preference, mm-hmm. I'm kind of training myself to be indifferent about the result. That's I tried. I didn't get it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
okay. Yeah. It's not going to ruin my night. I get to speak to you instead. Yes. And
I'm not sure that I'm much substitutes for Taylor Swift, I have to say, but there you go. Thanks.
Well, you know, I'm certainly feeling relaxed about it. And okay. if you think about all the things that you desire, a lot of them are outside your control, your complete sure. control. So getting tickets to an event, being invited to a party, being successful in getting a rental property. You know, there's always other factors and other people competing. And if you're okay with the result, no matter what it is, then yeah. you're less likely to suffer. And that's kind of why ataraxia was so important for the Stoics, because ultimately they just wanted to minimize suffering. They're like, life is going to throw a lot of suffering at us, including, you know, a lot of the Stoics lost children young.
Right.
Disease was rife. They didn't have sort of antibiotics or the medicines that we have today. So there was wars. It was a very violent time. And so being able to train yourself to suffer less was a very valuable skill. And I think, you know, today's world is also very chaotic and very,
very much so.
Yeah. And so to have the skill to be able to be calm throughout it all, to not get carried away with the drama of what's happening, mm-hmm. I think is important. Yeah,
and there is a lot of drama around
there
this.
Is a lot.
And, you know, and it's draining. I think you have to recognize what the toll is, the emotional toll and the energy, you know, the brain capacity, the worry. You know, I guess, you know, as I said in my intro, you know, one of my mantras is to try and worry less, particularly about the things that I can't control, because it's just senseless. It's a senseless emotion. It's a waste of my brain space. So I guess in a way I was kind of being instinctively stoic without consciously making that decision.
I mean, a lot of stoicism is so it's so practical, and people have read my book and said, oh wow, I've been practicing this philosophy without realizing it. But it is a coping strategy and a framework, which I think is really useful. And some people, like yourself, it comes naturally to, but other people like me, I've had to really work at it. You know, it's not, you know, I've had a lot of drama, used to seek it out a lot.
Mm.
And I've realized, oh, it's just, you know, it's not necessarily serving me.
No, it's, you know, potentially damaging. And I think, I mean, your book, I have to say, is brilliant. It's also a great gift, you know, and I'm thinking of, you know, a few drama queens in life who could perhaps learn a lesson or two with a little handy read of this. I mean, from your book, you do say that everything kind of ultimately equalizes. So high highs would therefore automatically mean low lows. Is that something that we're just going to have to get used to and look at everything and through this lens, as you say, of preferred indifference, which I have to say is going to be my new favorite phrase. I absolutely love that.
it's a bit of a tongue twister at the start, but then yeah, it's great. And just quickly on the preferred indifference, the three of them that I keep coming back to are wealth, health and reputation are the things we should prefer, but they're out of our control ultimately, so we should be indifferent. But we can go back to that. I think you know, your question of the low lows versus the high highs, I think it's a real trade-off, you know, like it's a real that was a hard one for me because I love the highs. Don't like the lows, but yes, love the highs.
For sure.
Love the feeling, love the dopamine. And it's a natural feeling too. It's really natural to feel great and on a high when good things happen. So in a way, you kind of to try and be ataraxic, you are hacking a bit of that biochemistry by halting the high, halting the excitement, and that way you don't necessarily drop down into the lows. I think it's, you know, I do miss the highs. I do miss that feeling of shrieking with joy. And I have it less now, whether or not that's just because I'm getting older and I've experienced a lot of things already, and so things aren't novel so much anymore, or whether it is the stoicism kicking in. But yeah, I miss the crazy joy, but I also don't miss the I don't miss the crashing lows either.
I guess that's the trade-off. You know, when you talk about being ataraxic, you know, does it mean that essentially, you know, we can never get truly excited about things or feel that extreme joy? I mean, are we actually limiting that, really?
Yeah, I think if you're being a purist, it there is a bit of a limit on it. But, you know, I still, you know, if I'm feeling pure joy, I just let myself ride with it. But I also kind of think it through. I think, oh, well, I'm feeling great. This is amazing. This is a great feeling, but it's it could have easily not happened.
Right.
It could have easily, you know, it could be taken from me.
It sounds a bit Eeyore-ish, I have to say.
Well, yes and no. I mean, because I don't get, it's much rarer that I'll feel miserable. So I used to swing between the two quite wildly, you know, big highs, bad lows. So the Eeyore, I mean, the ancient Stoics had a lot of joy in their lives. So it's not anti-joy. You can still definitely have joy.
Good.
But it's the chasing the things that are external and then being thrilled when you've got the you've got the apartment that you've applied for, you've got the job, you know. And there's going to be times where you don't get the job or you don't get the apartment, you don't get the raise. So it's about maybe finding joy in things that just exist. So I get a lot of joy from, I'm just looking out now at Sydney Harbour, which is just at my door, and I get a lot of joy.
Stunning.
Of the view, you know, or of, you know, it's been really sticky and humid here, the joy of a cool change, or the joy of, you know, catching up with friends. There's a lot of joy. It's just not as, you know, it's not as kind of giddy.
Okay. I get that. And I guess that kind of principle of having a calm equilibrium, that would apply maybe also to external validation. So presumably we shouldn't allow ourselves to get too excited about lovely compliments that we might receive, praise from others. But by the same token, it means that it's easier to ignore the criticisms and the hurt as well.
That's one thing I'm actually quite strong on, which is, I mean, it's great that people like the book, but also people don't like the book, you know.
Right.
There are people that don't like it and there are people that like it. I'm always, you know, I'm pleased to hear feedback, and if it comes unsolicited, great, but I don't read reviews. I don't read Goodreads.
Really?
I just don't, because I will get feedback from my editor, so people that work with the book that can help improve it. But if I start opening myself up to compliments and I don't open myself up to criticism, I'm going to have a unbalanced view of my work. So I'd rather not hear and read anything and just be guided by the people that are editing it and by my own instincts about if the work's good. I think being a journalist, and you would have this also being a podcaster, your work is public. People comment a lot. So
for sure.
The Guardian didn't have comments on my stories or my column because they were so vicious, you know, a lot of things.
Oh, my gosh, comments a can lot be of the, vitriolic. It's so hurtful.
That was
bad. It's hard to ignore them, but you just do, I guess, you know, live like a Stoic.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you're starting out, when you're a younger journalist and you're on Twitter and you're feeling good about something you've written, and then, I mean, sometimes people used to send me mean tweets. Like friends of mine, I'd be like, stop sending me this.
Yeah. And it have kind you of seen fits. This? It's really awful. It's like, no, I haven't. Stop sending it.
Stop sending it. Yeah, I wonder if there's a bit of, you know, unconscious.
Yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, pet hate. But it can make you, it definitely made me self-conscious about my style when I got such intense feedback from readers.
And yes, and that's a new thing when you think about it. You know, I've been a journalist for 40 years or so, and it was never thus. You know, it's now that people have the ability to comment in an instant. And, you know, it's so easy, isn't it? You get, you know, 500 really kind, lovely comments, and then you get the three or four that are positively vitriolic. And, of course, they're the ones that stick.
Which is kind of why you shouldn't read any of them.
Why you shouldn't read it. Yeah. Any of them, okay. Yeah, I get you.
Yeah. Don't read the praise, don't read the criticism.
So with your book, I mean, your book is brilliant. Do you allow yourself to be proud of what you've done, you know, and to be moved by the idea that it's selling well?
What I'm proud of is when people come up to me and say, I've read your book, it helped me through grief when my mother died, or my brother is spending time in jail. He's having, like, this is comments that people have given me. I've sent it to him and he's finding it helpful. So I like it when people find it useful. But the thing is, the next book could be terrible and not sell. So I have to really be indifferent. What you can do as a Stoic is just do the best you possibly can. You can't control people's reaction to your work. So you just have to do what you can to make the work as useful or as readable as possible. And then the rest is out of your hands. So I think there's Stoic lessons in publication of any kind or performance. You know, they talk, I think it was Epictetus talked about the lute player or the, you know, some sort of ancient instrument, and you can practice all you like and you get on stage and, you know, you could be out in an amphitheater and it's windy and you're playing really well, but the sound doesn't travel to the audience and you get booed and... You know, that is out of your control, that weather.
Right.
But
yes.
Your practice, your passion, turning up on time, you know, that's all within your control.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea that it is leading to this element of control. And I guess Stoics believe that we don't have to take control. We have to accept perhaps that we really don't have any.
We have control over a huge area, which is our own characters. So
right.
So there's kind of roughly three areas where we do have control, and that is our own character, our actions and reactions, and how we treat other people. That's all within our direct control, and everything else is either partial or not within our control. But the Stoics had this sort of, you know, some of them believe that the most important thing was a virtuous life, and that you can control. Like, and there are four virtues that they believed in. One was courage, then wisdom, temperance or moderation, and justice. So you have control over whether or not you embody and strengthen those ideals. And so an example might be you are given a terminal diagnosis, so a disease, and you can have all the treatments that are available, you can do the right thing, but ultimately the progress of that disease is out of your control. But what is within your control is to face the problem with courage and to show courage. And that was a very important virtue for the Stoics. So how courageous you are in the face of adversity is within your control. The adversity, however, is not.
Got you. And also I picked up on what you said there as one of those four points being temperance or moderation. So I guess that would apply to something like overindulgence or maybe even addiction. You know, I'm thinking maybe our relationship with food, which is something that we talk a lot about on this podcast. Are there some general principles that apply there? You know, there's some fascinating stuff in your research about the benefits of habituating to small hardships.
Well, yeah, they had an early version of like the 5-2 sort of
fun. Did they?
Fasting.
Fasting,
yeah, they did.
Cool.
Seneca, in his moral letters to Lucilius, which is a great book for anyone wanting a really clear explanation of a lot of the, a lot of the elements of Stoicism. Mm-hmm. It's him writing to a young man about Stoic lessons, and there's one letter where he talks about, fasting, not eating much, and then.
Yeah.
When you do eat, so if you've not eaten for a couple of days, when you eat a tiny portion of food, you rejoice because you haven't had anything. So like a tiny portion of barley or lentil soup or something very plain. So, you know, they had huge, particularly the upper class Romans, you know, huge feasting culture. They were constantly yes. like, you know, lavish banquets. And the Stoics would say, well, expensive food and good wine is a preferred indifferent. You know, it can be taken from you at any time. You could lose your fortune, not be able to afford to buy food or high quality food. So it's best to accustom yourself to cheap food, infrequent food, you know, days without food.
Makes sense.
So when it does happen, like the misfortune strikes, you have the ataraxia. You're able to cope with it.
Right.
Because you've had these days of fasting.
Makes perfect sense. Well, stay there, Bridget. We're going to come back in just a moment and talk more in depth about some of these extraordinary core principles held by these amazing Stoic philosophers.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Okay, so let's get into some of the key principles that we need to understand if we want to live like a Stoic. I read that negative visualization is a core practice. I mean, to be honest, it sounds a bit grim. What is it and what benefit can it have in our lives?
It's a little bit grim. It's imagining the worst, you know.
Should we really do that? I mean, how helpful is that to imagine the worst? I mean, aren't we just setting ourselves up to fail?
I started doing this when I was working, when I started working on the book, I started doing negative visualization.
It's like the opposite of manifestation, isn't it?
It is. You don't want to manifest a negative visualization, tell you what. But I went too hard and I got a lot of anxiety because I was imagining like everyone I loved being killed and, you know, terrible car crashes.
Awful. Why would you do that?
Well, the point of it is you just are meant to do it a little bit. So say if you're visiting your parents, you know, my parents are getting older. And so on the way there, just imagine that this will be the last time you see them, you know, that they'll die shortly after your visit. Your visit then will be richer, is the hope, because you will be fully present with those people. So you won't be on your phone, mm-hmm. you won't be distracted. And the whole point of this for the Stoics was to enjoy the people in their lives while they had them in their lives. It was to recognize life's short, people can just drop dead. We all
live
die.
Live in the moment.
Live in the moment. A friendship could end randomly. So you don't know, when you see your friends, you don't know if this is going to be the last time. So treat everything as if it's going to be the last time. And this has a twofold effect, according to the Stoics. The first effect is that the time that you are with them, when you're thinking this could be the last time, it's a richer time. You're more present. And the second thing is, if it is indeed the last time that you see them, you've inoculated yourself a little bit about their death. So you're not as shocked. And the third thing is, actually, there's less guilt because you're not sitting around wailing, saying, I should have appreciated them more.
Sure.
Because you had sort of thought about them as a finite person and acted accordingly.
It's interesting, you know, we're not very good, are we, at talking about death and grief in our Western cultures. Has Stoicism changed your personal feelings about death?
I won't know that fully until it's more of a reality for me. I wrote the book without having had serious grieving in my life. You know, I know it's ahead, but friends of mine who have lost people very close to them, when they ask about the Stoic way of grieving, find it very, very inhospitable and quite a cold approach.
Right.
And they talk about grief as coming in waves, and it's very hard to control. So, you know, but it's, if you, you know, like Marcus Aurelius lost 9 out of 14 children, I think, that he had.
Gosh.
And Seneca lost a baby son. So that they were dealing with sort of loss that was, you know, it was much more frequent.
Yes.
And they had to be able to get on with things. You know, they had to be able to wake up the next day and go about their lives, not with a stiff upper lip, but, you know, imagine if 9 out of 14 children die and you're grieving 7 years for each child, it'd be terrible. So, you know, that's not to say that there wasn't a lot of sadness and grief around those losses, but they didn't believe in grieving for a really long time.
Yes. I'm really intrigued actually by this whole being present and making every moment count. And, you know, it's a bit like, you know, The Power of Now. I've finished reading Eckhart Tolle, and it's about the only reality is what we have right now. And that there is a kind of a crossover there, isn't there, I think, with Stoicism.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've just read The New Earth, which I really enjoyed, of his. This Stoicism, Buddhism, more sort of New Age philosophy, there is connections all the way through. And there's probably some, you know, just some universal truths in each of those things. Mm-hmm. But it is absolutely a universal truth that we all die, absolutely. And how we live our lives is something that's really worth examining. You know, it was examined in the Bible. It was examined by the Stoics. It was examined by all the other Greek philosophies, Greek and Roman philosophies. And it's been examined, you know, it's just part of human nature to want to know how to live in a way that's going to really honour the time that we have and also cope with loss and death and things like that. And I think one of the problems in the modern world is, as you said before, you know, we don't really talk about grief and death. We don't know how to. And I feel like right now we're not really living that well. So we're in a bit of a bad state.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned there about time. You know, what have you learned about time being our most valuable resource, and how can that understanding affect our outlook and our actions, how we view time?
So, I mean, Oliver Berkman's got a great book, I think it's called 3,000 Weeks, about time and how we spend it. And Seneca had a brilliant book called On the Shortness of Life, which is also about time. I despair a little bit because a lot of the systems that are in our world, like capitalism, aren't set up for letting us use and enjoy our time in fantastic ways. In the UK and definitely in Australia and, you know, in a lot of countries there's a cost of living crisis, people working multiple jobs, housing's expensive. There are all sorts of things that make us, I guess, focus on how to use our time to earn money rather than use our time to be with others. And so until we sort that out.
Right, yeah.
It's going to be hard. I mean, a lot of people found, you know, people had mixed experiences with the pandemic, but it did give people back, if you weren't homeschooling and you weren't an essential worker, so those of us that were lucky enough to be working from home and not have caring responsibilities, you know, it gave us back some time. And
it did.
Yeah. You know.
It did. And made a lot of people reframe how they see their life and how they spend their time.
And absolutely.
I think a lot of us have ended up with a bit more home working, maybe.
Yeah.
But
life swung back into shape pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So people had amazing realizations about how they wanted to live. And then where are we 2 or 3 years later? And I just wonder how many people have been able to make permanent changes.
Well, one of the things that the Stoics recommended that you talk about is seeing that your emotions are a product of how you think about the world. Is that useful understanding now for our lives today, do you think?
I think it's debatable, actually. So, you know, the Stoics came up with that idea thousands of years ago, prior to neuroscience, prior to a lot of sort of understanding about the unconscious, about patterns that run through families. You know, there are emotions we feel and patterns that we have that aren't as easy to control as the Stoics would say they are. We can control a bit. I definitely think it's possible to control anger. I'm less convinced about that one. They do talk about being able to control desire, but I think there's a lot of, you know, hormones and various things at play there that wouldn't have been very well understood in the BCs.
They probably weren't talking much about menopause, were they, back then?
They definitely weren't. They weren't talking much about women at all. So,
no, for sure. Did women even exist, you know?
Yeah. I think with desire and things like that, how I think of it is I can desire something, but I have to be aware that whatever I desire is out of my control to get. So it's bringing it back into that frame of ataraxia. Like say if I'm, you know, I've got a crush on someone and I'm really into him and, you know, it'd be great if that was reciprocated. And so I have desire, but, you know, I can't control what he thinks. So if I get let down, you know, and everyone has been let down romantically, I'm sure, it does feel crushing. But the Stoic, you know, the Stoic lesson is to try and move on quite quickly from those sort of things because it's not within your control.
Got you.
Desire for something like a material good, like a better car or a nicer house, I think they're desires that can be tamed a bit.
Yes. I mean, coming back, I guess, to that expression of preferred indifference, you know, things that you would prefer, but actually ultimately are indifferent to the outcome.
Absolutely.
That's a big learning for today's society when we're encouraged to be so materialistic and that whole notion of desire actually is so prevalent. You know, you have to look at social media, you look at Instagram, you know, every single day, every minute of every day, it's telling us to desire something more than we have. And I guess, you know, a lot of us on social media could learn a huge amount from practicing a bit of stoicism here to measure that, to sort of kind of be, to counter it.
Because I think with desire, you desire something and then you think, if I get this, I'll be happy. And then you get it and you're happy for 5 minutes and then you desire the next thing. And you're constantly chasing and there's not necessarily a point in time where you feel like you have enough. You know, a lot of the Stoics, Marcus Aurelius talks about taking, you know, the view from the stars, you know, view from above, which is when you desire something or when you want something, remove yourself, look above, you know, am I just sort of replicating a pattern that is rife throughout our consumerist society of wanting, getting.
Right. Yeah, when you put it like that, I mean, the Stoics, I guess, you know, we're preferring to live in reality rather than this kind of dream world that we have of hopes and fears and aspiration. It is very much about the here and now and being quite grounded in reality, not letting emotion play too big a part of that.
Absolutely. I think they still had, you know, they still had ambitions and that they still wanted stuff. You know, it's a rare person that goes through life without wanting anything. But I think we've got to be more conscious today of how we're marketed to. We are, you know, if we're on social media, everything is coming at us. That's, you know, there's far more ads on Instagram now than there was a few years ago.
Gosh. Yeah.
I did some research this week on landfill from fast fashion, and it's extraordinary the amount of clothing waste, fashion waste. Because people get stuff that they buy on Instagram, they only wear it once or twice, and then it goes to a charity which can't sell it because it's falling apart, and then it goes into landfills. So it's looking at, well, what's the cost of our desires, not just to ourselves financially, but what's the cost to the planet? And, yeah, I think the Stoics would be, they'd be appalled. They'd be like, you don't need 25 jackets.
No. I mean, above all, and as you say in your book, you know, Stoicism is a practical philosophy that you can use in almost all situations. And I think, you know, when you look at, you know, environmental issues, that's probably a really key example of that. Actually, something else that we hear a lot about nowadays is journaling. I used to be a little bit dismissive of journaling, to be honest, but my daughters encouraged me. Yeah, now I love it, you know, as part of a gratitude practice. And I think, is that something that the Stoics saw as beneficial as well, either journaling or practicing gratitude?
They were early journalists.
Weren't they?
Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which is, it should be on every bedside in the world. It's such an incredible book. And that was his journal. It was, it was to himself, you know, his own diary that he kept when he was out on campaign. He would write in it each night, and it would be an instruction to himself about his character and death and how to deal with his fellow human beings and how to deal with his own appetites. And it was journaling. And the fact that we have access to that journal, I think, is extraordinary.
Isn't it?
Seneca also wrote, you know, at night. I mean, they did it at night because they'd reflect on the day. They'd say, okay, so it was the opposite of manifesting where you say, today I want, you know, I want to get a pay rise or I want to get 10 compliments from strangers or whatever. They would look back on their day. They wouldn't necessarily write about other people. They'd write about how did my character go today? You know, did I, in that stressful meeting or that stressful situation, was my temperament good? You know, was I relaxed or did I get angry? Mm-hmm. Did I behave? You know, how did I behave? Because that's what they cared about. They cared about measuring their own character, their virtues, not about what other people did, because you can't control other people. You can only control yourself.
That is just such a truism, isn't it? And I think, you know, just to finish here, you found Stoicism in 2018, and the years since then have been particularly uncertain and chaotic, terrifying at times. Have you been grateful for having a very clear set of tools during that time that you could call upon, especially, you know, given what's happened over the last few years?
Absolutely. I just credit Stoicism with so much, you know, with giving me a framework which you can really apply from cradle to grave. You know, you can apply it into your relationship with nature, your relationship with your family, money, health. It's a bit like, so I was brought up Catholic, and, you know, you go to Mass every Sunday and you are given a homily or a sermon and you are given Bible readings. then at school the lessons are drummed into you again. So Stoicism is like that. You have to keep returning to it. You can't just read the books once and then hope that you'll become a certain type of person. You have to return again and again and again to the principles, because they, you know, you forget them. You revert back to wanting everything, getting upset when yes. you don't get your own way, getting angry. So it has to be, I'm grateful for it, but it is a practice, you know, it is right. a slog.
Yes. Okay.
You don't just read my book and then walk into the sunset.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Read it and action on it.
Read it and reread it.
Okay. Read it and reread it. Bridget, it's been such a pleasure to have this conversation.
Oh, this has been great.
You know, you have opened, hopefully, ears and eyes and minds to something that, you know, as you say, has been around for thousands of years, but is still so incredibly relevant today, if not even more so. So I'm
spookily
very grateful.
Relevant, spookily. Yeah. Spookily I'm grateful to the Stoics. So they're the ones that I just repackaged it for my, you know, my own crazy life. But
we're grateful all round.
Does work.
A bit of gratitude. You're going to be going into my gratitude journal for the end of the day for sure.
Oh, thank you, Liz. And I'll journal about you as well. And, you know, what could I have done better? But no, it's been a pleasure.
Not much. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, what a completely fascinating take on living well in the 21st century, all rooted those thousands of years ago. I love that expression, preferred indifference. You know, that has really struck with me. And of course, learning a new word too, ataraxic. Yeah, something that I am going to be trying to live by. How about you? Let us know. Of course, you can comment on Instagram, particularly. That's our kind of preferred method of communication. Keep it kind, obviously, in the comments. You'll find us at Liz Earle Wellbeing, or me personally at Liz Earle Me. Well, all of this has made me think a bit of the chat that I had with Sarah Wilson last year. She takes herself off on hikes around the world, following in the footsteps of philosophers and deep thinkers in the hope of discovering more about how she can lead a more content and less indulgent life. And we had a comment here on Instagram, at creamroses65, enjoyed that particular episode and wrote, I read Sarah Wilson's book, I Quit Sugar, pre-pandemic, so it was great to learn more about Sarah's journey from burnout to recovery. I particularly enjoyed the discussion about the importance of nourishing ourselves on all levels in midlife, wellness, fun, and having a sense of purpose. That life is a journey with a range of mountains for us all to climb, learning every step of the way, and there are new adventures waiting to be had regardless of our age. Yes, at Cream Roses 65, what a brilliant outlook. Well, if you haven't heard that episode, do go back and listen. It's a really interesting one. And if you subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts for a very small monthly fee, you can listen to that and all future episodes ad-free. And we also give you early access to new episodes. So that's a lovely little treat. Well, what do you want to know more about? Which part of midlife are you finding the most difficult or challenging? Do send me an email. You can write to us now, podcast@lizellewellbeing.com. Love to hear your thoughts on that. So until the next time we chat, go very well. Stay stoic. Goodbye. The Liz Earle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Liz Earle, and is produced by Anushka Tate for Fresh Air Production, with additional production support from Ellie Smith.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.